Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Now, right now.
Now's the time to do the right thing.
That's right. That's right. We are going to stop the fussing and fighting. We need peace. We need peace in Africa. We need peace in the U.S. We need peace all over the world. But the only way we're going to get it is to fight for it. So that's what this is all about. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And this show is about people all over the country, sometimes over the world, who are fighting and organizing for transformative change. They are fighting against racism, patriarchy, homophobia, Islamophobia, Zionism, but they are also fighting for justice, for democracy. And so we have two guests today that are going to help us understand what's going on in the continent of Africa, because we're about to celebrate African Liberation Day, which came out of a particular struggle with the independent countries coming together. And so I am absolutely honored to have Bill Fletcher, and me, Akute, come on, because these are folks who understand Africa. Bill Fletcher has worked with several labor unions, and I think some of those working with them took him to Africa, to be in solidarity with some of those workers' struggles. But Bill is also the former executive director of Trans Africa, and a senior scholar with the Institute of
Policy.
And he's written a few books, but he's also a prolific contributor to many other journals and publications. He is born in Ghana, so as the brothers would say, he's a homegrown brother. He's also a policy analyst. He's the founder of Democracy and Conflict Research Institute, which is based in Accra, Ghana, and he's the former executive director of Africa Action. But what's interesting to me, he's a former editor at Trans Africa. And because that's a connection that you all have, I'm going to be asking about that later, but not right now. So me has lived in Nigeria, but he's here in the U.S. And so both of these brothers have been on many media outlets, just folks trying to pick their brains about what's going on. So I am truly honored to have them here. Before we dive into the four countries that I have some interest in, I just want to get your take on the Palestinian question. And we know that now protests are all over here in St. Louis. They are at Washington University in particular, because it's a private institution. They have really been heavy-handed in their approach to both the students and faculty, and one of the people I know has been basically fired. And so they are not relenting at all, and the young people are not either. But I do want to, just from a policy standpoint, it's interesting that President Biden has said that Rafah is the red line, which means something is supposed to happen if Netanyahu, who's already vowed that he's going to attack whether there's a ceasefire or not, that's going to happen. So what position is that putting Biden and I would say the U.S. in, when you've already said this is the red line? If you go past that, something's going to happen from us. What's your take on that?
I'm not sure, Jamala, because what would need to happen is actually a deployment of U.N. troops to Gaza as an intermediate force to enforce a ceasefire and to ensure that the Israelis don't move forward. I would doubt that the United States would support such an effort. So it's hard for me to figure it out. I actually believe that Biden is very worried about what could happen if the Israeli offensive goes forward. But he has shown, and I believe the reports, that he's expressed his anger with Netanyahu. But what I don't think enough people appreciate is that Biden is a Zionist. I mean, he's pro-Zionist. This is not simply a matter of pragmatic politics or other such things that you might have seen in someone like Obama. This is someone who believes this and seems to seriously believe that the security of Israel is critical to the security of the United States. And that is blinding him to the actual situation and the implications of his own policies.
What about you, Nate?
And, yes, it's a pleasure to be here with you and Bill. And if I may step out of lane for just a second, you introduced Bill as former executive director of Africa, Trans-Africa. He was actually the second, the president of Trans-Africa. When he and I became very close. Now, I agree with what Bill just said. Although I separate the two, I mean, I agree that the only thing that makes sense to me about Mr. Biden's policy is that, yes, he has this strong belief in Israel, which Bill rightly characterizes as he's a Zionist. But I also, and then the second point that Bill made that I agree with, but I link them differently, is also that it appears that Mr. Biden links American security to the security of Israel. So to me, that second part is actually hard-nosed global politics. I actually think, because the thing that weighs on my mind is that, you know, not too long ago, China shocked everybody by getting Iran and Saudi Arabia and Iraq to start talking, so that China was moving into the area and being the peacemaker. And it seems to me that that is the hard-nosed politics that the U.S. is playing, that we don't want China in there, so we will be there and try and bring the two sides together, the Sunni regimes with Israel, and we want to make sure that they don't have good relations with Iran, the Shia regime. Now, I'm no expert on the Middle East at all. You should know, in over 40 years of activism and commenting on public policy, even in the classroom, I never talk about the Middle East because I feel like I don't know enough at all, and it is such a dicey area. But what has been happening with the protests and everything actually shocks me very much. The only thing I will add to is I think that the role of Congress, initially the Republicans, getting these university presidents, starting with Dr. Gay in Harvard, being pushed out. And I think because of race, and now it has spread. And what surprises me is that a lot of Democrats have also joined in, and they are all against the students, which shocked me because I think freedom of speech is so important. But to my, it seems to me like it's being sacrificed.
I totally agree. I think, the protests are really pushing people to take sides, because you can't be on the fence on this particular issue. And when I look at what Biden has done in the past, he's, you know, done these sharp condemnations, and then he sends these big fat packages of aid, military aid over there. So he says, oh, don't cross this red line. I have no faith that, you know, first of all, Netanyahu is going to cross the line, and that Biden is going to do nothing. So I think all that's going to do is inflame the protest more. And I'm not just talking about protesterdom. There's more to the protest than us folks on the campuses or folks in the street. You know, people are lining up to see how else are they going to have some impact on that situation then? So let's obviously we're going to all keep an eye on that. But oftentimes, people don't consider that part of the world as part of Africa, which always just amazes me. So we're talking about Africa today, and that is a part of Africa. So just so that my listeners know. So I'm going to take us to Nigeria first, because I know you spent some time there,
Yes.
And in fact, it's interesting that you passed over two small countries that nobody ever hears about to get to Nigeria. But we know that just recently Shell sold some of its oil holdings for something like $1.3 billion, and that's billion with a B. But they have been known in that region to just be environmental enemies of the Ogoni people. And so I'm just wondering, you know, you got all these, you know, multinational corporations there, mucking up stuff, but Nigeria government is like, you know, benefiting from the oil, profits and that kind of thing. What is the situation there in terms of not just the oil, the transfer of the oil, but what's happening with the people in that area that have been victims of shale oil?
Well, thank you. Yes, and of course the oil is in the southeast region, which with the various reconfigurations of the states that make up Nigeria, is now occupied by many different, the area has been split into several different states, although under colonialism, under British rule, it was southeastern Nigeria, and the dominant ethnic group there are the Igbos, but the oil is in the Niger Delta, which is not part of the area claimed by the Igbos. Anyway, I say that because you are right. The things that they have done in Southeast Nigeria in the oil area, the pollution, which is unbelievable. I mean, I visited when I worked in Nigeria. I was living in Lagos and Abuja, but I made a trip to Port Harcourt, and you step out of the plane and your eyes are watering because of all the pollution in the air. And the air is the best part of it because the waters and the streams and the soil has been polluted beyond imagination. And this is what the local people depend on. My point is that, yes, Shell have sold their holdings there, but it's because they didn't clean up the place. They were taken to court on a sliver of grievances in UK and they lost. So they are offloading this and jumping out because of climate change. You know, I think that climate change is not being dealt with properly, but the news is getting out that we need to stop pumping so much gases into the air because that's what is warming the earth. So I think they are getting out quickly. So you are absolutely right. I mean, the things there are terrible. But the main point is, it's today, if you read Nigerian papers and the major international papers like The Economist, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, they don't cover that at all. If they cover it, even Nigerian papers, the number one news now is a horrendous economic situation in Nigeria. Nigerians are absolutely suffering. They can't make ends meet. Now, I obsess very much, and I'll defend it. I'm not abandoning that. You need, I might get in trouble with Bill here, but that we need democracy. You know, we need people being elected, because I have seen lots and lots and lots of coups. And now I am the most anti-coup person you can come across, because I don't think they do any good at all. So I give Nigeria marks because they had elections that, you know, everyone says they didn't go very well. And there have been other coups in West Africa. So I am scared that we might get it in Nigeria. And I'm glad that they don't have it. And their new president Mr. Tinubu has been saying the right thing. So on democracy, I give them a bit of mark, but the economy is in terrible shape. Inflation is huge. And then even the macro economy, the IMF just came out and said last year, and for about 10 years now, Nigeria has been the number one economy in Africa. Well, the IMF says this year, it won't be number one anymore. South Africa will be number two. Nigeria will even be number two. Egypt will be number two. And Algeria will be number three. Nigeria has slid down. It's going to slide down to number four. And one doesn't know where the sliding will end. So I will leave it there. I think things are not going very well. But I'm hoping that they will hold on to the democracy and then trying to climb out of the economic hole. As for the mess in Southeast Asia, Southeast Nigeria with the pollution, I'm at a loss because I don't see anyone really talking about it properly.
So, Bill, I'm going to let you respond to the elected versus who, but I do want to say the complicity or the liability of the Nigerian government to the multinational corporations.
Yes.
What Bill, do responsibility do they have for the mess that's been made while they were still raking up profits? It was seems like little or no accountability to the environment during that time. And I can't help but think about some of these have to be carcinogens that are now infecting people where they have disease and who's taking care of them in an economy that's pretty busted. So what's your response to that, Bill?
Thank you. We're directing that to Bill, right?
Yes.
Let me, if you don't mind, let me first start with the coup issue. Because not sure what Nee thought I was going to disagree with him on. There are very few coups that I've ever seen that I have thought are progressive. Perhaps the only one is when Thomas Sankara took over in Burkina Faso. Part of the problem is that military leaders think like military leaders. No surprise. They don't think as paragons of democracy. And so the coups that we've most recently seen in the Sahel region of Africa have been, let's say, complicated. Because one has to look beyond the rhetoric of the coups and actually look at what are the programs of the regimes that have been put into place? And who are these coup people anyway? So I find it really interesting. And in almost every case, coup leaders were trained in the United States. And they weren't trained in the People's Republic of China, weren't trained in Cuba. They weren't even trained in Sweden. They were trained in the United States. And that to me raises some interesting alarm bells. Then you add on to this the engagement that they have started with the Russians, first with the Russian mercenary groups and Wagner. And I keep posing a question which got me into trouble with somebody. I said, well, what's the political character of these regimes? And no one seems to want to address it. They seem to be more interested in talking about how the coup regimes are anti-French and anti-US. So that and a couple of bucks get you across town. I think it's important for us to dig deeper. In terms of your question, Jamala, answer to me is to some extent historic, that decolonization of Africa hit a certain point in the early 1960s. When there was a great debate about boundaries. And the question was whether to retain the boundaries that the colonial powers had imposed on Africa, or as Nkrumah and others argued, whether there in effect had to be a renegotiation of the boundaries. I would say that any of the problems that the continent faces has to do with a wrong decision that was made on that. The consequences is that these colonial boundaries bore no relationship to historic questions on the continent and the peoples. You know, in Nigeria, for example, in northern Nigeria, it's mainly Hausa. In the country to its north, Niger, the southern part of Niger has Hausa. They were divided between the British and the French. It wasn't like the Hausa said, oh, let's have a vote and decide whether to go with the British or the French. So we've got to, it's really important that people look at the historical roots of the situation. And then the regimes that took over overwhelmingly, although they may have initially been democratic, were weak. They were often undermined by former colonial powers. The Democratic Republic of the Congo is a case in point in terms of how Lumumba was overthrown. So what we see in Nigeria is a long-term relationship between the multinational corporations and the government. I agree with Nii on the importance of democratic elections in Nigeria. I think the Nigerian government, however, has not been handling the Boko Haram insurgency very well at all, relying primarily on military force rather than understanding the politics of the situation. So it gets complicated. Long answer, forgive me.
No, I think that was an excellent point to bring up about the boundaries, because when you start to look across the continent, it plays itself out over and over again in terms of that. But then you have, you know, the neocolonialism that replaced colonialism, and then those two things and other complexities just make it for a really, really situation that's really hard to predict. So I'm gonna take us across the continent to Sudan, because the same kinds of things were happening. But also, to me, and you and I have talked about this, Bill, very little key attention on the Sudan. Last year, actually almost a year ago to date, you know, you had another war that started. And, you know, when I look at it and I say the people that are involved, clean, you know, there's a African proverb that says when two elephants fight, the grass suffers. And I always think about that when these regimes get to fighting each other and they're displacing people. People being killed. I'm talking about innocent people that have allegiance to neither side. So, you know, you got these warring parties, the armed forces, the Sudanese armed forces, the SAF, and you also have the rapid support forces. And so, you know, this has been a long conflict, but what is in store? What does the future look like for the Sudan?
Well, you know, Bill, ended up by apologizing for how long his answer he claims was, and that made me blush, actually, because mine was like three times longer than his.
So,
and I say that because I have so much to say about the Sudan. Because, you know, I started at TransAfrica in 1981. At that time, the president of Sudan was a coup maker called Numari. Reagan made best friends with him and used him to stabilize Chad. So one of the war criminals, few war criminals that Africa has actually tried was Hissène Habré, created by Reagan, help of Numari. Numari was overthrown. I say all that, and I'll try very hard to keep my answer short, but there is so much that I'm frustrated with, because you are right, the little media coverage that we get makes me scream, because to me it is so short and so badly reported. Even if you cut it today, you know, it's in the news that as we speak, El Fasher is being attacked by the rapid forces by Mr. Hemeti. Now, he gets his support from the UAE. He is close friends with the United States. Security Council just held meetings on saying, oh, how terrible it is. El Fasher should not be attacked. People there might be massacred. The estimates are about maybe 800,000, almost a million. And I'm thinking all the U.S. has to do is to put its foot down with the UAE, because the UAE is rich, but it's very small. It's totally dependent on the United States. So I get the impression that folks in power are saying one thing, but behind the scenes, they are just saying, oh, Sudan is not enough. Let them kill each other. Okay. I mean, my answer is so long. So I'll just make one other point on it. The issue of, coups. You know, Bill corrected me. So I'm glad we both hostile to coups. Bill, by the way, I would say consider, I mean, a progressive coup in my head is also the coup by Amadou Toumani Touré in Mali, where he deposed a 22-year-old regime headed by a general who was killing everybody. And he was a one-star general, and he removed this four-star general who had been running the country and killing people, held elections and left. And so he became one of my heroes, Amadou Toumani Touré. So if you ask me, I'll add that to the two coups that may have had a good future, but it didn't. They never end well. So on Sudan, when it comes to coup, I say to people, because I think where we might, I mean, I have no confidence in coups now. When I was a high school student, when Nkrumah was overthrown, I was shocked by it, but we thought, well, okay, maybe things will be better. They never got better. Coups always make things wrong. And when people argue for coups, I say to them, if you want to know how military rule ends, today's Sudan. It always brings other soldiers want to replace the coup makers. And in Sudan, we see what happens when two parts of the army start fighting each other, and they've destroyed Sudan completely, and they have not stopped. As we speak, they have not stopped. So these are just bits and pieces of how angry the situation in Sudan now makes me. And when I hear U.S. officials saying, oh, this is terrible, I'm thinking, you can, with one phone call, get the UAE to stop pumping arms into Sudan, and it will bring the fighting down. But that has not been done.
I know that you spoke about the UAE, and for my listeners, that's the United Arab Emirates.
Yes.
But there's also some other outside forces, Bill, that have put their noses in the thing. You got Russia, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, who
Egypt,
are trying to
yes.
play a part. Egypt, I mean, what, you know, it's already bad enough. And then these people are in there trying to defend their own particular interests. So speak to that, Bill, but also I want you to speak to the fact that there's already a division in the Sudan because the country's been divided. I don't even think most people here in this country know that.
That gives me an opportunity to say a little bit about history of the area. The Sudan was, up until a few years ago, the largest geographically speaking country in Africa. And, it was dominated by the British, called the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, which is actually a misnomer because Egypt was a neo-colony of Britain. So it was dominated by Britain, and it became independent, correct me if I'm wrong, in 1956. And there, with other parts of the continent, brought together these different populations that, to a great extent, had no real historic relationship with one another. You had a so-called Arab North, so-called because they understand Arab as a culture and language, to an ethnicity. That's what the North was. And you had a Muslim but non-Arab West, like Darfur. The South, you had the what's now South Sudan, which was so-called animist and Christian. Almost immediately after independence, a war broke out in the South because the southern part of the Sudan felt discriminated against by the North. The North, forces from the North had dominated the region. And that goes back to what happened in the 19th century. But in any case, the war gets settled. The person that Nee mentioned, Mary, came to an agreement with rebels And things seemed to be cool for a while until Numeri started feeling threatened. Did what Saddam Hussein did some years later in Iraq and happened elsewhere, which is that they seized onto Islam in a very opportunistic way and used that to try to suppress his opponents and unite a bloc. Then a war breaks out again in southern Sudan, this time led by something called the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement under this visionary leader, John Garang. And their objective, interestingly, was not the secession of the South Sudan, but they wanted to change the Sudan. But they also wanted to make sure that what happening to the people in the South was addressed. Killed in a helicopter accident. And the new leadership of the SPLM fight for independence is reached. Now, Northern Sudan wanted to hold on to Southern Sudan because Southern Sudan has oil. It was the major repository for oil in the Sudan. They didn't want to give that up, but they ended up giving it up. But then South Sudan almost immediately fell into its own civil wars. Essentially been, it's remained a tumultuous situation, and it shows you how a nation state is easy, sustaining one is not. And the secession of the South Sudan was something that I always had questions about. Then you have the, what was going on in the West, and Nee mentioned this rapid reaction force. That was the institutionalization of this militia, Janjaweed, used by the former dictator of Sudan, blanking on his name. Right, I'm blanking. This is what happens when you reach a certain age, right? But he used Janjaweed in order to try to suppress dissent in Darfur. Takes the Janjaweed and makes them a paramilitary force.
Omar Bashir.
Al-Bashir, excuse me, thank you. Makes a paramilitary force alongside the military. Because Al-Bashir was cruel, but he wasn't stupid. He understood that there was a possibility he could get overthrown by his own military, because he came to power through the military. So to keep his military in check, he basically institutionalizes the Janjaweed as a counterforce. Now, Al-Bashir gets overthrown in a popular uprising. The uprising does not fully democratize the Sudan. A rapid reaction force and the military created the uprising, and then ultimately they go into war with one another. So someone recently pointed out what we're witnessing in Sudan is not a civil war. Is a fight between two militarized factions of the state. Neither of these factions have any support at the level. They carried out the insurrection against Al-Bashir, have been trying to find, and actually they've created various kinds of organizations, but they're not armed. And it's not in a position, at least at this point, around this factional fight. And destroy and affect both sides, which is what I think actually needs to happen. I think that both sides are irredeemable. So that's what we have. So we have to understand this is not a civil war. And when Nee is mentioning the UAE, Jamala is, and we see a very similar thing in Libya, where these different countries have decided to create mischief. In the days, it was the US and the Soviet Union that were backing one side or the other, right? Soviet Union's gone. So now you have these more developed Turkey, Egypt, UAE, Saudi Arabia, just to name a few, Russia, as well as former powers like the United States and France that create mischief, stirring things up and supporting different factions. And that's part of what we're witnessing in Sudan. That there's certain alignments in favor of rapid reaction force versus the military. And a very similar thing going on, by the way, in the Syrian civil war. where in the beginning it's a popular uprising against the government and the and then what happens is these outside forces start getting in, particularly Saudi Arabia, and then ultimately Turkey. They get in and they start funding different sides and from balkanization. Something similar happened in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are here with Bill Fletcher and me, Akute, and these are, they might not consider themselves experts, but these are my experts on Africa. And as you can see, there are more that meets the eye when it comes to the continent. One is that we get distorted and I would say intentionally misleading information. But also when you start trying to unpack it, you see that there are so many fingers in the pot, you know, that is, you know, I think sometimes people feel like it's going to be impossible to sort it out. And the thing that I think comes out most prominent, at least for people here in this country, and I would say specifically and particularly for those of African descent, is Black folks fighting each other over, you know, resources, and we'll never get together. And in fact, that's just a little tip of it. It's like all these other competing interests that are in there. So it brings me, before I go to another, go ahead.
If you admit me, I mean, I think Bill's answer is great. The history is so complicated and so vast and long. I don't disagree with anything. I just want to add, especially because I thought you were landing now. If you are in the United States, even in my classes here, I say, well, you need to know what your country has done and hasn't done. Otherwise, it's all overwhelming. Like, why is everybody coming to the U.S. and say we should solve their problems, whether it's Ukraine or the Middle East or South Africa or this? And I say, you need to know. So on Sudan, Bill's answer is great. Two things that I'll just add. You know, you mentioned that I was executive director of Africa Action. When they gave me that job in 2006, the number one issue for Africa Action was Darfur. So we focused on it. So the Janjaweed and Hemeti and all these people are coming back to me. The war across the Red Sea in Yemen, where they will come to Sudan and take young Sudanese and pay for them to go and fight. And they were mowed down. So, you know, the Red Sea, many people, this is also a concern in Israel, that all the surrounding countries want to make the Red Sea an Arab pond. As in Sudan, as Bill correctly mentioned, the Janjaweed was created to put down local groups in Darfur that are quote-unquote non-Arab, okay? So you've got this Arab thing that the Red Sea belongs to us. And so that's why UAE and Egypt all interfere. But my point is the role of the United States has been far stronger. And here is one instance. In 2006 and 2007, when Omar Bashir, who himself has made a coup, was sanctions were slapped on him by the U.S. But at the table, the George Bush administration was cooperating with him because of the war in Iraq, and they were using him to infiltrate people into Iraq, even though the law says, you know, we've sanctioned him and we can't deal with him. So they were cooperating with him. His spy chief used to be flown to Langley, the CIA, to come and talk to the United States. So the United States, on the one hand, publicly said, we hate Bashir, we have nothing to do with him. They were cooperating with him. And that is part of the complicated problem. So the U.S. has fingers all over Sudan, like they have in a lot of issues, but in Sudan particularly. And when I see the analysis, and that is not mentioned, and it must be stressed, Bashir himself was a general who made a coup. And then he created the RSF to try and balance the main military. And the other thing, the so-called overthrow of Bashir, because the Sudanese civil society, if you ask me, the only civil society that might compare with him on the continent of Africa in terms of their effectiveness are the South Africans. They pushed, and I think what the two generals did, not that they overthrew Bashir, they sacrificed Bashir. Bashir was their boss. Bashir created both of them and was leading them. And when the heat got too much, they threw out Bashir. And I think the big mistake made, some of it even by civil society, was that they said, okay, there is a coup, Bashir is gone, so we have a new Sudan. I was here in Washington saying, no, you need to get rid of the military. You can't have a military and a civilian government where the military is dictating to the civilian government what they should do. I think the civilians were in a hurry. They wanted the sanctions lifted, so they agreed to coexist with the military. And then when it was safe, that's when the military just brushed them aside because you have no guns and they feel like the pressure is off. So anyway, I will leave it there. The Sudan situation is heartbreaking and is very complicated. And yes, everybody is playing a role. I just read that UAE is working with Museveni in Uganda to fly weapons into Sudan for the RSF.
Let me just throw one more thing in here because it relates to something you were saying. And my point is directed at African-Americans, U.S. African-Americans. Looking at Africa and Haiti, it's one black group against another. Not how the people there look at things. People would often talk about the kind of racial conflict of Sudan around Darfur. And that it's like the Arabs against the Darfurians. Muslim, by the way. I just want to point that out. But the northern Sudanese themselves Arab. Okay. Issues of al-Bashir. African Americans say the guy's black. The issue of identity doesn't play out the way it does here in the United States. And this was something that was very noticeable during the Rwanda genocide, when a lot of U.S. African-Americans could not figure out what the hell is going on. How could these black folks, one group of black folks, wipe out nearly a million other black folks in 90 days? It's like, is this just simply insanity? And because colonialism of the continent, settler colonies in the continent, was different from white supremacy and settler colonialism operated in North America, ways of identifying. And African Americans need to get that. Opposed to throwing up our hands and saying, we'll never get our stuff together.
Point before we go to the next country, and that is both of you had a relationship with Trans Africa Forum. And it sounds like in many ways the policy of African action, or was it Action Africa? But we don't have that now. And so I think a lot of us relied on institutions like that to help filter the information, to help direct us to where targets should be, to what we need to be doing to help what's going on in Africa. And I don't think we have that. Maybe I'm out of it, but is there any group that can, what's going on, to give us the information and to say, here's what's really going on? Because I think in the absence of that, you have people on their own devices just looking at it visually and say, oh my goodness, here we go again. Black folks together.
Seriously. I mean, it's like, you're absolutely right, Jamala. In the absence of Trans Africa Forum and Africa Action, there are a few people, individuals around, and it's like at the top of the list, that have a level of insight and knowledge of the continent and are able to talk with regular people. Problem, see, I'm not going to speak so much about Africa Action, but as the former president of Trans Africa, I was that 1994, Trans-Africa, in some sense, began to die. And because of two factors. One was the democracy in South Africa led many U.S. African-Americans to say, our job is over. It's complete. We've won. Year of the Rwanda genocide. My predecessor, Randall Robinson, was one of the few African-American leaders to speak out on the Rwanda genocide. Most of African-American leaders said nothing, nada, about it. I cite 1994 because it becomes very clear after 1994, if it wasn't clearer earlier, looking at the situation in Africa, or for that matter, within the entire African world, simply doesn't racial analysis. It's complicated than that. The problems that I ran up against in trying to rebuild Trans-Africa, which was in a mess when I took it over, was that a lot of people were into nostalgia. They wanted the 1980s again and the anti-apartheid movement. But when you start talking about the complexity of issues as needs articulating, right, about Haiti, about Afro-Latinos, about what's going on in the continent, about Western Sahara, right? My issues resonate in the same way. And Africa Action encountered a very similar problem. And we have been successful, even though people like me and I and others have talked about it, we haven't been successful in identifying a new organization with a new project. And the one final point on this is that what further complicates this is that people that attract 1970 view of the world. So they look at leaders and they pay attention to the rhetoric of the leaders, but not practice. A leader uses anti-imperialist rhetoric to them and say, okay, this must be what we, opposed to looking at, like, what's actually going on? Who are you aligning with? Created certain fissures, the movement that me and I are a part of.
Yes, it's a good segue, Bill, to the recent election in Senegal. Somebody, here's this radical, young, left-wing pan-Africanist who basically had an anti-colonial platform during his campaign. He wins. And so many people around the world, but I suspect particularly in Senegal, are saying, you know, the future's bright, we're getting ready to move on a different path. He's all these possibilities with him. But then there's these two thoughts that are, one is, because of politics, end up like Fumi Touré, James Diani, Robert Mugabe, who started off very progressive and then got caught up in sort of the neocolonial, you know, powers where it was all about power and privilege. But there's another thought that says, you know, he could end up like, because here's somebody who's already saying, I'm going to audit the oil, gas, and mining sectors. And that's these white folks are saying, wait a minute now. So what does the future look like in Senegal with this new leader, dynamic young brother, youngest ever to be elected? What does it look like for him? Because we don't know what's on the ground. We know he had a lot of support, but he's going to have to compete with all of the interests that had their hands in the pot. He's never had office. There's some, you know, thinking about like his management, his skill set for this humongous, you know, task that's unfolding before him.
Sudan, I mean, I'm so sorry, Senegal, I breathe a huge sigh of relief. Worth celebrating. By the new president is everything you say he is, but contrasted with what was going on in the rest of the region. Because Mr. Sall, Macky Sall, he was in power. He did some good things, and he was a forceful spokesperson on Africa in certain areas like food security and climate change, messing with the transition fair election, because he wanted his party to stay in power first, him, if it wasn't him, his hand-picked person. Uh-oh, here we go again. We are going to get another coup. And if we had a coup in Senegal, it would have been that you can go from the Atlantic in Dakar or Sudan, you know, metaphorically speaking, if you could drive or fly, you will be in military-controlled countries all the way, which it means the bigger proportion of Africa. And again, I think military regimes are horrible. So it was a good thing that he won. He won well. I mean, I look at that to say, okay, great, but now comes the hard part. Because I have reason to believe that France helped to ease out Macky Sall, and we don't know the deal that he made with Macky Sall for Macky Sall to all of a sudden say, okay, I'm releasing these two guys out of prison, and we're going to have the elections. I think we should give great credit to Sudanese civil society and voters. I was saying that the Sudanese and the South Africans have had the best civil societies in Africa. I apologize. Once you add the Senegalese, they have always given, Macky Sall is not the first one who tried to stay in power, but they have always opposed any president trying to stay and push them out. But now comes the really hard part, because the military that did not take over also is very much in bed with the French.
Right.
And in all of our discussion, I would tell you, even the recent coups, I dislike all of them. But the thing that they did that was clever, they knew that if they turn anti-French, they will get all over Africa, because the French have been horrendous colonizers during colonialism, and worse, they gave pseudo-independence. And so there is no question in my mind that we should not be, you know, sanguine about them. In fact, I think one of the big mistakes of U.S.-Africa policy, I have seen it over many, many, many presidential administrations, is like, well, Europe is important. It has oil and Israel is there, so they are important, and we need to worry about China rising and, you know, opposing us. And so we need to worry about them. Oh, Africa? Yeah, let the Europeans take care of it. Let the French take care of it. And they've been doing this since the end of the Second World War with De Gaulle. Let Africa take care of it. Even to this day, of course, when I've said it to U.S. policy officials, they have denied it, but you can see it very clearly, even under Mr. Biden. I can't do it. You know, when he went to the first G7 meeting, it was in Italy, like it's just been recently, and he's a Catholic. Yes, he's a Zionist, but he's also very much, his own religion is a Catholic. He went to see the Pope. When he finished seeing the Pope in the Vatican City, where did he go next? He drove straight to the French embassy in Vatican City to apologize to Macron. And we are sorry about, you know, stepping on your toes with the Australia submarine deal. Therefore, and Macron said, okay, if that's the case, then you won't complain about anything we do in Africa. And it was like done. And I've always said, oh my goodness, how can the U.S. tie its policy so much to the French, who are hated across Africa for good reason? What I'm saying is France had a role in Senegal. So I applaud the Senegalese people. I applaud the new president, but I'm still holding my breath, because France has so many levers in Senegal. And in fact, the things that he has said are going to upset the French, because they have so much fingers in the Senegalese pie. I'll leave it there.
I want to add what Niamh's raising, that the other part of this, Africa has a long history of great leaders. Mass organizations is a really mixed bag. So back to Thomas Sankara, the Burkina Faso, who was one of my heroes. I disagree with him on a number of things. Popular in Burkina Faso. A lot of changes was a pan-Africanist and internationalist and murdered by his, like, closest ally. Overthrown. Mobilization against the revolution. Campaigned in power from, I think it was 1987, when it was rising that overthrew him. And the thing is that there are these great leaders. Lumumba was another example. And in the absence of organization, very by an imperialist power, and or through domestic collaborators, or just opponents. And so my concern in Senegal is simply an organization at the base. That the French, as Ni so eloquently put it, are bed with the of the Senegalese military. If you know what happened elsewhere, what steps are you taking to build an organization among the people that could count? That there's been a great track record in the continent on this, and something that has to be looked at.
Because when I look at the Francophone countries, they make up a large part of Africa, and so yes. The French have been there not only in a colonial role, but they continue to be there, manipulate, and as you say, causing mischief. And so to disregard their tentacles, I think it's been probably a mistake for those leaders who are coming up and on the horizon or in place now to think that somehow just their mere presence is going to mean that these folks back off because they got so much to lose. They've been there for hundreds of years.
The paranoia, which is what I think Sékou Touré did in Guinea. Sékou Touré was the only leader in what was Africa who stood up all and said, no, we're not going to be part of the French. And de Gaulle made him pay big time.
Heavy.
Destruction of Guinea. And came as he should have been a hero. Except what happens then is internally, you know, it's like that saying, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean people aren't out to get you. It's like there was a level of paranoia that develops in the regime. That of what a colonial Guinea could have offered the continent. So you got to be careful. You got to understand that, yes, the French are there. Cut you off at this. But it's got to rely on the people. You've got to build mass democratic organizations that will sustain you. You're not going to do it simply by jailing opponents.
A bit here and sort of get editing work, because actually where we are now about building a counter force that Bill is describing, which I agree with completely, that good African leaders need to build a counter force. I want to link to what you mentioned about the demand of Trans-Africa and Africa rushing and how we don't have this effective in the U.S. I think we, at least I'm telling you what my vision is, what I've been trying to persuade Bill about, not that we disagree much, but that weighs on my mind that the statistic tells me that there are 5 million, what the census calls, African-borns, like me. And you know, like all immigrants, we are very homesick. So we flee back and forth physically or electronically with the home countries very much. After Trans-Africa and Africa Rushing, we need to build new organizations. We need with these groups, the African-born and African, some of the churches who also have connections with Africa, but usually it is church groups going to visit be good. I tell myself, and sometimes I tell Bill, that's what I'm trying to do. When you say, you know, you should write, you should go and talk. And I'm like, look, I'm looking for a few people so we can organize, because I think we can create such an organization. And the reason I'm linking it to Africa is what I've always said to people here is, look, there are very courageous democracy fighters and people who are on the continent, but they get very easily killed. Critic of Rwanda and Paul Kagame. And so I can tell you chapter and verse about the people he has killed, the people he has harassed, even in this country, in Britain, in South Africa, in Kenya. He goes after you. And so I think that if we build this kind of strong organization along the model set by Trans-Africa and Africa Action, we need to build new ones along those lines. Pressure on the government to say, you should not be protecting a Paul Kagame or a Museveni or a Sisi. They go after their opponents. In fact, when Obama was elected, my point was, you know, Africans were so happy. I think he should tell them, look at me, I'm a minority. The good enough democracy. Minorities, you know, you can run, so you need to make sure there is democratic room in your countries. And I think the U.S. can do a lot, but of course the U.S. government is not going to do it until there's pressure. So my point is, we need to build the group here that will put pressure on the U.S. government, and then the U.S. government will withdraw support from these African leaders. Because for all the U.S. talk of democracy, if you look at who they support on the African continent, your job will drop beyond them and say, okay, let the French have their way. Support some hoary dictators in Africa, and they kill their opponents. And therefore, it isolates the leaders. So my particular pet dream is we rebuild. I mean, young people are coming up all the time. And I have to tell you, I'm gray-haired. I've been doing this for almost 50 years. I'm not ready, actually, to leave this thing. I keep saying, look, I want to work with young people. I want them to know what I don't want them to 50 years to learn what I learned. I will hand it to them, and they can pick and choose what works and doesn't work. So if they absorb it in 5 years, it's like handing the baton, so they can run with it. But I really think that we need to build the new institutions in the U.S. who pressure the U.S. government and say, if we don't like your Africa policy, we are not going to vote for you. I'm not an expert on the Middle East. But in fact, what is happening now is actually something that I have been dreaming and saying to myself the whole time, that people who support Palestine need to speak out and need to hold the feet of the politicians to the fire. That's the only way they're going to change their policy. So now I need to take my own medicine, my own prescription. We need to do that. And when we do that, we can see better outcomes on the continent. And I think what it takes to do that, it's a step down in terms of the lofty ideals. But I think one of the big problems is getting a few good people getting together and finding decent money to put together the organizations and hire people. One of the problems with doing work for Africa is you are supposed to starve while you are doing it. Meanwhile, the groups that are exploiting Africa, they have so much money that they can hire somebody to argue against you and pay them a lot so they don't have to worry. I would get there, but I think you can link the two powerful advocacy organizations in the U.S. will protect some of the best democratic upshoots across Africa, and that will help with what Bill is advocating, which I agree with completely.
That's a powerful note to end on, because I did want to talk a little bit about Africa, but I would like for you all to come back, because we got an election coming up. This is the 30-year anniversary of South Africa's new government, and things have not gone well. This may be the first time that the ANC will not be a majority in Parliament. So there's lots of things going on in South Africa, but if you all would come back after that election so we can dissect that, I would definitely appreciate it. But I think the building of an organization that mirrors, you know, those two organizations that people were really counting on for their understanding of Africa, and the fact that you both have unpacked so much and you know, pull back some of the layers of things that we don't even understand. And to me, Bill, even sometimes it seems like the people in those countries don't understand their own history about how these tricks continue to be played. So we got some work on both sides to do. But I do want to end with, where do you all see the silver linings? Is there any light that we could see in terms of Africa? We know that there's lots of chaos that's been created. There's lots of suffering that's been created. Is there a silver lining anywhere in the continent that we could say, wow, there's hope here? And you talked about, you know, what's happening in Senegal, but is any place else that folks seem to be understanding what democracy looks like and don't get into office and think, oh, now I'm liking this. I want to be here for life.
I think Bill should go first because it's such a tough question.
In goals at the base, I would say that the struggle power against the Moroccan occupation, the Sario, the liberation movement is trying to do, gives me hope. I have a love for South Africa, and despite all of the problems that South encountered and decisions that the different governments have made that I agree with, vitality of the nation, social movements, including but to the trade union movement, give me a sense of hope. And so hope in Africa. But I had a segment of an interview with Eric's, you know, the leader from, Blackwater. It was Blackwater, but then they changed her name several times. And the guy is really, really bad. About in this broadcast was that the West needed to recolonize Africa mess, and that, the West should go in there and do something. And I'm saying Americans who would agree with him. And I was thinking that United States, Africa, in ways defies imagination. And what good for this? Because what they'll do is they'll say, yeah, that was in the past. Let's get over that. Right? And it's like, wait a minute. I mean, we're talking about dividing up a whole continent of its people and for its resources that have tried to assert independence. And you're going to, optimism is that the decision that's made by every government and every social movement leader, but the people haven't given up. And, because I think it's too many of us have given up.
But where is the bright light? There is some rising, I won't say stars, but some rising movements or rising leaders that we could say, let's keep an eye on that and see what's going on.
Bill's great answer will make it easier for me. But to be present, because I guess the way I'll put it is an inflection point. That gives me hope is actually the history that Bill mentioned. And Bill, to tease you, I'll say, you are right. They divided up the continent. They've stolen our resources during colonialism, Berlin Conference and all that. But later I'll tease you. I think the worst thing they did to Africa was the 300 years of enslavement, Atlantic slavery. And far more, colonialism didn't help. But to scoop out so many people and bring them here, cause fighting among and just destabilize the continent over 300 years. And as for Eric Prince, yes, I heard his comment. And I actually, I had a comment on my own. And Bill, what you say about African leaders needing to understand that there are ogres out there, enemies out there who want to devour them, so they need to build protections around them. So I agree with that so much. Actually, that would be my excuse to say, Bill, the reason I always sometimes keep my head down is I'm thinking first we need to build strong organizations so that when I go there and I speak and I come home, I don't lose sleep because I know I'm part of the group. If I go out alone, I get worried. But you are right. I think the history is so bad. And with Eric Prince, what I said, and I think the answer to him is, listen, go read your history books. Africa is in a bad shape. But the bad was because of 700 years of European being involved. And you want to go back and bring more people of European descent. They created the problem in the first place. Now, I thought what he said should be dismissed. But then I reminded myself, he said this to people who actually believe anything. Mm-hmm. They believe anything. So we should not leave that hanging out there. We should shoot it down very quickly. But it makes sense. So I see I'm very worried. Like I see Senegal's civil society and the populace and their culture of opposing a bad president gives me some hope, a little hope, because the bar is so low. And then, of course, civil society of all places, Senegal. If we can boil down, and I think Sudan has fantastic civil society, and especially led by women. Now, on South Africa, I'm not that pessimistic, but maybe I'm wrong. You see, because my reading of South Africa is this. The name was used for the government beginning in 1948. But, the European settlers were in South Africa in the 1600s. So they were there for about 3.5 centuries. Was there for all this time. And they have damage. So the ANC government is not going to, turn the place into paradise in 30 years. Yes, they have made mistakes. They've done things that I don't agree with, but I don't see anybody that even comes close, especially when the white minority that put in place white supremacy and stole everything now live behind gated communities and say, okay, now we have democracy. Minorities have rights. We have rights. So leave us alone. And they don't have anything to do with the mess we created because Nelson Mandela forgave us. I always like to say they love Mandela because they said, oh, he was this kind person who forgave us. I love him because he was a revolutionary. Okay? He was revolutionary. So for me, when I look at South Africa, I think the whole issue is me. I mean, they haven't even done land reform. And they don't want to do land reforms. That is why they are punishing Zimbabwe. Okay? Because it's like, if you dare do what Mugabe did in Zimbabwe, this is what will happen to you. So they want to freeze the problems they created. They are behind the gates and enjoying their money. They don't even want to pay higher taxes because South Africa needs reconstruction after apartheid. That takes money. And get the money from the people who stole it and who keep it. So I think I look at South Africa's situation is very difficult. But, we'll see how the elections go because their main opponents, outside of the ANC, what used to be the ANC coalition, the others were all in bed with apartheid. So how are they going to think they can win big? And the other thing that worries me is there are people now in Congress who are putting together laws to punish South Africa for a number of things, including taking the case they took to the ICJ, how dare you do this? And so we are going to punish you. So Anyway, I know it's about where the optimism is, but I think that finally my optimism is sort of diffused to say our people, and I'm telling you, I say this to Bill and I'll say it to you, and I blush because I say they must think he's just saying that to us. I mean, when you look at the history of what African Americans have done, and I mean black people in the Western Hemisphere, tell you, as somebody born in Africa, I was in my late 20s before I got to the US, I can tell you, blacks in the hemisphere and the miracles that they performed, the huge problems they overcame, tell me that we can't give up because there is something in us that will allow us to solve even this problem too. I may not put the precise point on it, but I do believe in our people that they do the impossible.
I, Dr. Lua, the struggle will continue. I want to thank my guests today, Bill Fletcher and Lee Pate. We have had such an enlightening, informative session here. I have to have you all back after that South African election so we can really unpack and break down and talk about that history of struggle against apartheid and where we are today. So this is Jamala, your host. Thank you for listening. I'll see you on the battlefield.